Hello, listeners. This is the Art Grind Podcast. I'm your host, Marshall Jones.
And I'm Tun Yai.
And Dina Brodsky is out in Beacon somewhere doing God knows what. Today we interviewed the great Frank Bernarducci, an amazing art dealer in New York City, sort of a New York City staple, really, since the mid-80s. This was a great episode for all you out there who want to know how to approach a gallery.
The do's and don'ts, mostly the don'ts.
Yeah, how not to approach a gallery, what they look for, what a guy like Frank looks for. Does he read those emails that you send, you know, with your images attached?
You'll be surprised by the answer.
Yeah, that's right, actually. So Frank was very candid. He's been a champion of our type of art for a long time. He coined that phrase, new precisionism. So it's for all of us renderers out there who like to paint all the little details in the paintings and make things look like things. Everybody, welcome to the Art Grind Podcast. Today we have an extra special guest, Frank Bernarducci. Frank has been a gallerist curator in the New York scene for many years, a really influential scene, particularly for the type of art we do, sort of more figurative, more representational, would you say, Frank?
Yes.
And so tell us a little bit about your early days. I had seen somewhere that you were sort of adjacent Andy Warhol, had him in a video at some point.
We Googled you, Frank. There was all this incredibly fascinating stuff.
We're
on
reading
Wikipedia.
My Wikipedia page.
Is this all to be believed? Because it was very exciting.
It's all true.
I can't wait until Frank gets here so we can ask him if the stuff on Wikipedia is all true.
It is all true. Yes, I was a student then when I met Andy originally, I don't know, in the early 80s, I guess. And he had the factory down half a block from where my loft was before I even had the gallery.
Around Union Square?
Yes. And I used to bug him for autographs.
Huh.
And, you know, he's very cordial, polite, and he would always ask for ideas, like he needed ideas to paint things. And
he would?
Yeah, all the time. And then I'd see him in clubs. I'd see him in the Palladium or wherever, the Mud Club somewhere. We'd be hanging out. There he was.
And he was already a big star by this point, right?
Yeah, super big. But toward the end of his life, actually, he was sort of very... People shunned him. He became, like, overexposed, I would say.
Okay.
Because after he was on, like, the Love Boat episode, people were just like, ew.
Sort of jumping the shark.
That's awful. And but he was always very upset, if you read his diaries and stuff, that his prices were so low relative to the other artists. Pop artists. And it wasn't until, about a year and a half after his death that the McGrubby brothers started buying up all his work and pushing the prices up at auction, and he became a superstar.
Mm.
And I think rightly so. Like, when, just as like a little aside, I had a show in my gallery called Photosynthesis, and all of the art was...
When was this?
1986.
Okay.
And all of the art was based... on, it was painting with photographs somehow. And Warhol was the king of that because they were photo silkscreen. So I went to the Castelli Gallery and I asked for a painting to borrow from my show. And, like, along the top row of the gallery, which was huge, were all of these dollar sign paintings. There were dozens and dozens and dozens of them wrapped in bubble wrap. So he sent one of his preparators up there and pulled four of them out for me, and I signed the consignment form right there, and Leo was very polite and going on about the work, and I took these four paintings home on the subway. I was like, well, this is unbelievable. And they were $6,500. So the show opened on Thursday and Warhol died on Sunday.
Wow.
So I got a call that asking me on Monday if I still had the paintings, if they were still unsold. And I said, yes. They said, well, if you have a deal on those, you can complete the transaction, but all the work is going to go into probate and keep the work for the show, but it has to all come back. And so I didn't have $6,500 to buy those paintings at the time. But today they're worth probably $1 million each.
Wow. Wow, but that's almost like a quaint New York arts. Like, you could go in as a young guy and get Andy Warhol's from another gallery. Like, that wouldn't happen today, right? Like, not even Andy Warhol, but like a middle-range artist. Does that exchange still happen?
I'm not sure. We borrow work from other dealers, and we're pretty cordial about it ourselves.
So Frank, you were a student at SVA. I'll say, I can't remember if we ever talked about it or if this is also coming from your Wikipedia page. How did you kind of transform for, like, I'm assuming you weren't like, you know, what you were studying was art and not, you know,
studied,
you know, a gallery directorship, but like, how did this happen?
Yeah, I don't know if there's a class for being an art dealer, but, I was a graphic artist. I worked in advertising, and that's what I went to school for. I took painting and drawing and all that, but I was more interested in making advertising ads and commercials. But I had a loft space, and I was hanging out in the East Village with a friend, a girlfriend, and she knew all the artists there and some of the dealers, so we'd go to openings all the time. It seemed like there was one every night, and then there'd be an after party at whatever nightclub. So it was a very social. After about a year of doing this, I thought, I either got to start painting or start collecting or open a gallery. So I chose being an art dealer. I decided to have a show in my space. I asked this guy to curate it for me, who was kind of a well-known curator at the time, Steve Kaplan. And we chose the artist to be in the show. He more or less did. And there were some well-known painters in the show, David Wanarovich, for example.
Okay.
And it was a funky space. It was a, you know, unglamorous loft space, unpretentious, I would call it.
Where you were living.
Yeah, where I was living, and I did my first show there, and we sold at Wanarovich for like $4,000. I go, wow, this is so easy. I'm going to quit my advertising job. And, you know, I just have a big party once a month.
Wow.
But it was a lot more difficult. The second show I did was with another dealer. It was called Double Vision. And it was the B-side gallery with Rick Prohl was involved with, you know, his work. And I'm still friends with him. But and that had more another group of East Village artists. And even Ronnie Catrone was in that show. I had Keith Haring. His work. Wow. And so it was a lot of fun in the beginning, you know.
And where was this space at?
It's on 17 East 17th Street.
Wow.
So it was sort of outside the East Village, really, but we called the first show North by Northwest because that was where it was low position relative to.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. Tun and I actually curated a show once at his cousin's loft. So, mm-hmm. Sort of.
And you guys sold things.
We sold a similar story. Yeah, we sold actually, a lot. That was
the most money we've made.
Yeah. I mean,
instead of selling our own stuff.
For the record, you guys made way more money, with that show than I did curating things for, like, actual gallery. Like, my curatorial fee was never, like.
We got to get back to these loft shows.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, maybe so.
Do you have any advice for, you know, like, upcoming curators?
I'll just tell you that one of the first shows I did, you know, my dad was a painter, and he and a bunch of other artists opened a gallery called the Phoenix Gallery. And at that time, hundreds of painters came to New York because they all wanted to be Jackson Pollock or Franz Klein or whoever. And there were no place to show. There was only like 5 contemporary galleries then. So they opened their own spaces, like on 10th Street off of Bowery. And believe me, the Bowery then was not, it was the Bowery. Like,
I've heard, yeah.
Drunken bums, and it was dangerous. Where was I going with this? So this guy came, he was a friend of my dad's. He came to one of my first openings, and he's like, he sees us. We would all buy our clothes, like at thrift stores and stuff. He was like, you guys are all wearing my old coats. Like, what the hell is going on here? So it was kind of a flashback for him, I think, to see us doing this in the 80s, what he did in the late 50s.
Uh-huh. Wow.
So I guess it's happening again. It's just, like, you know, continue.
So what was it like growing up with a painter dad?
Great. He, you know, he had a home studio. And
and you grew up in New York City?
Yes.
So this was in the house, paintings in the house, yes, the whole time.
Yeah, always paintings in the house, always so the smell great of turpentine and oil paint.
Wow.
Very familiar.
Back when it was real turpentine.
Yes, and he, you know, passed away in 1990. I still have the coffee can with his brushes in it.
Really?
In my apartment, yeah.
What kind of coffee? Chock full of nuts? What kind of coffee?
It's Savarin.
Nice. Oh, that's great. And I read, again, Wikipedia, sorry, he studied with Hans Hoffman.
We prepared really well.
Obviously. Was that?
Yeah, that's good. There's a lot of information there, so
Frank,
it's helpful.
Frank, we spent weeks preparing to interview you, and we came up with this.
Yeah. Yeah, I was on the street asking questions, and I found out, no. But there's another overlap, because I teach at the Art Students League, and Hans Hoffman taught at the Art Students League. Is that where your dad studied?
No, he had his own school, the Hans Hoffman School. School of Art, it was called, and he had his own theories on color and stuff, and he had, you know, it was like a waiting list to be in his, go to his school. He was the man, you know, and I think he's the most underrated of that whole group. He's my favorite artist, actually. I love his color,
his
sense,
color's
and
terrific.
His compositions. I mean, those guys were all great, but
Frank, it's so funny because the stuff that you champion, and there aren't that many people showing representational work in general, and new precisionism, which is, I think, a term that you keep. I mean, you came up with that term, right?
Yes.
But it describes a certain form of realism, and for me, that's actually very, very far from what Hans Hoffman and possibly your dad were doing. Like, do you feel like it's a sort of rebellion?
No, not at all. I think that. It's not intentional. What happened was I was showing all different kinds of work in my first gallery. And then there was a recession. I closed. I went uptown to work for Tatishev Gallery, and he was a figurative painting gallery. And he showed some well-known people. And after about 3 years of working there, I left to go to Fishback. And they were probably the top figurative gallery at that time in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. This was in the 90s already. And so you meet realist painters, and you meet collectors, and you meet critics and writers. It's a whole, you know, world of...
The corner of the art world.
Yeah.
You know, and we all happen to inhabit.
So, and a lot of those painters are still around. When I decided I want to have my own gallery again, I knew I wanted a partner, and I approached Mizell, and he, of course, is Mr. Photorealism, and he appreciated where my background, which was those two galleries and my own gallery. So I continue showing realism, working with him, not exclusively photorealism, but we got a little pigeonholed because of that, but I didn't think there was anything wrong with it.
Photorealism.
Yes, even though that's not really all we showed. Like, mm-hmm. anyone who came to our gallery could see a lot of different kinds of painting, you know, figurative painting, but there were a lot of, you know, we showed Dina's work. She's obviously a plein air painter.
Uh-huh.
So I'm not going to suddenly stop and start showing conceptual work or political art. It's just impossible to shift gears like that.
But you have an admiration for it all.
Yeah, I'm a collector, and I don't just collect what I show, although I try to get at least one painting by each artist that I represent. It's getting a lot harder because the work's getting more expensive. But I try. And I stick with it, and I think there's a real need for, you know, representation.
Right, yes.
There's just a few galleries left who are showing it exclusively.
For sure.
And I want to be I want to have my own niche within that, which is the new precisionism came, if you know precisionist painting from the 1920s and 30s, those artists were painting bridges and tunnels and construction and railroads. And it was kind of a cynical look toward the future. Like, what is this, where our country's headed? I think it was a kind of a, it wasn't a positive viewpoint, 100%.
Metropolis or something.
Yes. Uh-huh. And today, the new precisionists are looking back at some of the same railroads and things and bridges. And I think it's an optimistic viewpoint. It's like, look how far we've come, or look what we've achieved kind of thing. But also, it kind of looks to the future. But I, there's a certain nostalgia there, is my point, that I think is authentic. So I decided that this was the right name for this type of work. Mm.
It's a great name.
Thanks.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it
and
sounds
you have,
like a it sounds like a real movement, you know.
Mm-hmm. It kind
of
is.
Who are some of the names that you would in that movement? Who are?
Well, I show Will Fisk, and I show Antonio Cazorla, and Adam Normandin, and Kurt Hoppe, and Esther Carini. I mean, almost all of my artists are have a technique, you know, that's pretty tight and precise, and they all have their ideas of what they're trying to portray. And most of them are painting things that they idealize what it is they're depicting. In other words, if they're painting a hamburger, it's like the most glorious hamburger you ever saw. It becomes something more than what it is. That's what I'm looking for in an artist. Like, most cityscape painters will just paint what it's in front of them, which is great. And if you have a style that can kind of transcend what you're looking at, then you're like Estes, for example. He has a distinct style. But most of my artists are doing things that are not so apparent. If you look at the let's take Esther. She wants to bring to the viewer's attention that wolves are endangered. And she did a whole series of them. There's only 30 left in the wild in this whole entire country, because wolves have a bad rep. Like,
wolves?
Just wolves, only 30 red wolves left. 30 wolves left in the wild.
That's
yeah,
crazy.
Exactly.
That's crazy.
It's insane.
I didn't know. So I knew Esther's Esther's wolf paintings are gorgeous.
Yeah,
but
they're
I had
gorgeous.
No idea that there was only.
But what she does is, like, she goes to the Wolf Conservancy, where they're, trying to preserve these things and breed them and so on. And she'll go there for weeks at a time and kind of just be with the wolves, be near them. And after about 2 or 3 weeks, then she'll bring her camera. And that's when she gets the shot, like, because by then they know her scent, they know her, they're familiar with her, and she gets a real connection to the animals. It sounds kind of crazy, maybe, but I think it's apparent in her work, because she's really successful now.
Wow.
With this.
Huh.
I mean, they're gorgeous and bizarre. Like, they're really, really strange paintings, too.
Yeah.
Like, they're not. It's not just a wolf painting. It's,
yeah.
You know, like...
actually sounds kind of dangerous. Remember that documentary, Grizzly Man, by Herzog? Remember that?
Yes.
Living with wild animals.
Oh,
is...
You know, wolves
yeah, that was crazy.
Less people than hippos. Hippos are dangerous.
Look,
so.
I'm not living with hippos either.
So Frank, kind of take it like you just, yeah, I mean, you're the foul, you named New Precision, you know, you made the movement.
Mm-hmm.
You also recently, started your own gallery, which I'm
yes.
sure everyone wants to talk to you about, but we want to talk to you about it too.
Okay.
Can you talk, the first show was a few months ago, I think?
Yeah, it was, first of all, it was time to leave 57th Street. I was up there for almost 20 years, actually. With my own space, with my own gallery, I was there for almost 20 years, but those other two galleries were across the street. So I worked on the same block since, like, 1991 to 2017.
So you wanted a different coffee
shop.
So
I was kind of sick of the food, first and foremost. I needed a new place to eat. And so I also, you know, Trump moved into the neighborhood. Well, I mean, he was there, but now all his security was there blocking the streets.
Oh, yeah.
Interfering with your art sales.
Yes, he was. And also, they're tearing down a lot of the gallery buildings because to make way for Billionaire's Row or whatever it is they're trying to do there.
Those buildings they're putting up on 50th Century are hideous, too.
They're just bad, ugly, and, you know, the buildings that were there, like Rizzoli, they just ripped those things down. Old mansions, you know, they should have been landmarked, but never were. So who knows? So we all had to leave. And like the Crown Building, which had some galleries in it, that was sold. It was Spitzer owned it, the Spitzer family. And now they're converting it to condos. So they wanted all the galleries out. They weren't renewing any leases. And, you know, this is New York real estate. If they want you out of there, it's like goodbye. They're not going to play games with you. Anyway, so I thought, I looked at the Lower East Side. I looked at the Upper East Side. But I felt like Chelsea was really the heart of the heart of the contemporary art world. And so I'm on 25th Street now between 10th and 11th in a ground floor space. And it's fabulous. It's just a whole different environment entirely. And there's people in and out all day, people from all over the world, a lot of artists, but, you know, people who collect and do things. So,
speaking of, a lot of our listeners are artists. So someone like you who has a gallery that would be really desirable for a lot of artists to be in listening to this. Is there a way
you know,
to?
You're gonna have Frank because of this. You're going to have hordes of, you know, young kids with portfolios lined up outside your door.
Yeah, everybody's always like, "How do you approach a gallerist and stuff?" Is there any advice on that? Is there any no-nos?
How do you not approach a gallery?
We're just going to give them your email address. You can vet them. And if you think they're good, I'll take a look. And what about, that's pretty much how it works.
Let's say best case scenario and worst case scenario stories.
Okay. I got three of my artists just sent random JPEGs. One was Sharon Moody. She's a Trump Loy artist. They weren't all comics then, which is what she does now, but they were like random Trump Loy paintings. And so I called her up. I said, these are quite remarkable. And I asked her what the prices were. And she said, well, I sold the last one for $500. And I said, well, first thing I'm going to do is buy one. And the second thing I'm going to do is give you a show. So that's what I did. And now they're $14,000. Nice. I still don't think it's a lot of money, but we've sold close to 60 of those things.
Wow. And that was just someone really who sent you your email, whatever it is.
Yes.
You hadn't met this
no.
person.
So
for the record, Frank is actually a lot more open-minded than most.
At people's submissions.
Like it feels like you actually do look.
Definitely going to get a flood of
submissions.
Yeah, fine. if you don't hear from me, that means you didn't make the cut. Because I'll contact you within 24 hours if it's something I'm interested in.
Wow.
I don't wait around for thinking about it, you know.
So I feel like I just met you on Instagram, and like a day later, you were in my studio, which
That
point was my apartment. But
you were a shrewd negotiator because you were like, I always wanted to do a show with my sister, and I also wanted to just show my trees. I want her 50 trees, and I'm like, okay.
You didn't actually want anything.
I just kept saying yes.
Dina has her ways of getting what she wants.
Yeah.
That's how I get guests for this podcast. I mean,
so it all worked out great, I thought. It was a great show we did together.
It was a good show. And me and my sister had talked about doing a show together for years. And that was kind of like you gave us a chance to do that. I thought it was your idea. It was
exciting.
It wasn't my idea. It was your idea.
Okay. I'll take the credit.
So thank you, Frank, for giving us a chance.
You're so welcome. But yes, we found you on Instagram. That's true. And a couple of my artists I found that way. Emily Copeland, she's 25 years old. She's from Canada, and she was just posting these charcoal drawings she was making. I'm like, if these are as good as they look, I called her up. I said, we'll send you a plane ticket. You can come to New York with the drawings. Just roll them up. And so she did, and the drawings were good. So we said, you could leave these here. Here's your receipt, your consignment, and we'll figure out a date, like how many can you do in a six-month period or whatever it is, however many she needed for a show. And they did really well, too. They were everything was under $10,000. That helps. But she had a successful show with us. So her next show is going to be in March next year.
Hmm.
Yeah.
What do you look for in an artist when you're looking at stuff? I mean, it's your taste seem to vary really wide. So what... When you're scrolling through Instagram or submissions, what is it that pops to you?
Well, I'm not so much looking for young artists anymore, unfortunately. I'm looking for work that I can sell for $100,000 and up.
Uh-huh.
That's a lot harder to find, but that's what you need to pay your bills because... When we had the 57th Street Gallery, we had like three rooms, and we could afford to do a small show there and then a major show in the front or maybe in the two side rooms or something. But now, like we having a show of Nathan Walsh in September, and these are big cityscape paintings about as big as this wall. They're like between 10 and 12 feet wide each.
Okay.
And those are – they – range in price from $150,000 to $185,000.
Okay.
And that's what pays the bills.
Uh-huh.
I don't do so much resale. That never has seemed to work very well for me. But if it's like I'm not running around looking for a Warhol to that I could flip and make however much money on, it just never seems to pan out. Maybe right. Some other dealers can do it, but it just seems like a waste of time.
So Frank, you just opened a gallery and you're talking about like kind of the people going in and out and how like cool and exciting it is. I just read this incredibly annoying article on ArtNet today, which basically said the people which basically went on about how galleries are closing because no one was walking in. I mean, it described like the polar opposite experience from what you're describing.
Yes.
But the galleries that they interviewed are like in the same, you know. So are they just full of shit?
Well, basically, I lost it on them. I don't know if you read my response to that article, but I basically said "fuck you, ArtNet" on Facebook.
You did.
And why are you...
Wait, in those words?
We like this.
Yes. Yes. It says it.
You got the art grind spirit, Frank.
And I'm like, first of all, why would you perpetuate such a story? You are an art, like, newspaper, technically. So you're cutting your own throat by saying that galleries are closing, perpetuating this bad news.
Uh-huh.
That is the stupidest thing you can do. For yourselves, let alone for everybody else. Even if it's true, it doesn't matter. Like, why don't you report on something positive? Like, it just doesn't make any sense. It's such a negative. The editor should be fired of that, whoever's running that thing.
I mean, it was like, it was written in this really smug tone, but it wasn't really proposing a better ecosystem. Like, it wasn't like, oh, galleries are closing, here's what's replacing them. It was like, galleries are closing, and like, I don't know, is art even worth making anymore, you know, or selling?
Was that what
right.
you say?
I mean, it was...
Kind of.
Like,
whoa. ArtNet saying that?
ArtNet.
Let's give up.
Yeah. I'm thinking, I mean, did Murdoch buy ArtNet?
Yeah, exactly. Was it like Trump?
Why?
Like, I kept waiting for them to be like, oh, yeah, but this other thing is totally thriving. But it didn't do that. It's just like, well, everything's bad. Everything here's terrible. You know?
I mean, I think, though, that you have to have – this sounds really maybe like some marketing guy, but you have to have a really high-quality – stable of artists. What does that mean exactly? I know what it means for me. No one walks into my gallery ever and says, my kid could do that. That never happens. I don't have that problem. But not everybody likes what I show. And critics in particular avoid me like the plague often. There's a handful out there who support what I do. But for the most part, you know, If the general public finds it appealing, then it can't be very highbrow or something.
That's interesting, that talking about critics, because the type of art we do, the type of art you show, historically has been sort of not the critic's darling. You know, you think of Clement Greenberg or something like this. What do you think is the reason for that? Why do you think it doesn't get the press?
I don't know. I honestly don't know.
So Frank doesn't strike me as someone who cares about what Clement Greenberg would think very, very much. And by the way, my parents would totally walk into your gallery. Like, my parents are so sick of realist art by now. They'd walk into your gallery and be like, yeah, my kids, you know.
Your parents
could do that.
My kid could do that. Your parents are the only ones. who can say that?
I think
that's pretty funny.
They've got my and Maya stuff like in closets, like being like, oh God, you know, this is their college efforts, their grad school, you know, rejects. But do you really care that the critic? I mean, like, you seem kind of punk rock enough in a way.
I'm trying to shrug it off. It's like, you know, you're not going to write about me. I take that as a compliment, actually, because you know, we're in business. And we have our client base. They don't care what you write about us or don't write about us. And we've had collectors buying from us since I opened. And they're in their 80s and they're still collecting, which is fabulous. And these are real collectors. They're not speculators. They're not flippers. Right. They don't ask what's the auction record of this artist. It's like, if I hear that once, it's like an auction record. The guy makes 4 paintings a year. And how do you, you know, nobody wants to sell one ever. So how's he going to be in an auction if, you know, he's not making a painting a day? Where, you know what I'm saying? It just doesn't. It's the wrong question to be asking.
Yeah, I mean, so do you think that, like, I mean, I feel like me and Marshall, or at least maybe I bitch about this and you nod and that makes it sound like you're agreeing, but we kind of bitch about the current state of the art world. Like, do you think there's something kind of wrong with whatever is happening right now art world wise?
Yeah, there's some big problems.
Could you talk? I feel like whoever's listening is probably sick of hearing us talk about the problems. Can you talk about the problems?
Fresh voice. So
I'm sitting on my gallery on 25th Street. And I have 3 employees, and I have other people working for us. We have a graphic artist. We have a PR person that are, you know, not on staff, but we have a preparator coming in. We have, you know, a lot of people in and out working and doing stuff for us, and 3 full-time employees. So we're a small operation. Across the street is the Pace Gallery is putting up their new Kunsthalle. It's 6 stories. And it cost $210 million, from what I gather from the construction workers. Apparently, they're not paying for it. Somebody else is paying for it, and they're leasing it back from the builders.
That's just gruesome.
So clearly, they are in a different business than I am. You know, those galleries need material, so to speak. So if you're a mid-level gallery, they're going to eat you alive if you have an artist that is even halfway successful. And if you end up showing with a gallery like that, you have to produce, because they have galleries all over the world and they need material. So you got to be working every day and making art all the time to feed the machine, you know. And who are the buyers? Who are those buyers of those galleries? Well, it's everyone you might think. There's museums being opened up all over the world. There are, you know, every time you turn around, there's another billionaire in China or in Russia or wherever. And everyone wants to show their friends, look what I just bought. And you can instantly recognize a Basquiat or a Warhol or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. And they just want to show you on their phone. And you, it's like instant status. I have an art collection, you know. So to get this material, you have to have Larry Gagosian's cell number or whatever it is you need to have access to this material. It's the opposite of what we do, which is we're always looking for people, new people to
who want to
buy something, whereas like they have the opposite problem. They're like kind of fending off the buyers and making lists and that kind of thing.
So Pace, actually, I cut Pace slack because the one show that I saw in Chelsea over the last few years that, like, really kind of blew my mind was mm-hmm. actually in Pace. And everything else I've seen there since has been, the same bland kind of, I mean, mm-hmm. the bland stuff that seems
corporate
to be.
Corporate art.
Yeah, it's corporate art. But they had a Rakeep Shah show. Do you remember that?
I saw it. Yeah, I remember that one.
It was so good. It almost makes it justifiable that they're now taking over Chelsea with, I don't know.
Before or after the Adrian Guiney show,
Well, Gagosian has some of the most beautiful shows I've ever seen, even in museums.
But it also has some of the most boring shows I've ever
seen.
Well,
he had the Wesselman show. I don't know if you saw that, but these giant three-dimensional, they look like cutouts of, like, lipsticks and keys and other pop objects. And there was one presented in each room. And they were – he only made, like, eight of them, and they were all together for the first time, never shown before. This is quite an undertaking to present this show. And Tom used to go to the galleries. Like, he came to see our shows from time to time with his wife. He was a very nice guy and a very unassuming artist and no ego. And so somebody cares about him and his work. And this is fantastic, I think. Yes, they have an ulterior motive. They want, you know, to raise the prices of the work, but and they've done it. Like, his paintings were not millions of dollars when he was alive. People thought, kind of wrote him off as a commercial artist, but not anymore.
So kind of if you could change the art world, or let's say even just Chelsea, if you could change it the way that you, like what does a Frank Bernarducci kind of art world look like?
Okay, first of all, I have music playing in my gallery all day long.
And
we are friendly. I know that's discouraged in a lot of galleries. Don't be friendly, just be austere. And I think that's actually a business model that's valid, but it's not my business model. I talk to everybody, even artists, if I have time.
even the scum that wanders in off the street.
Well,
I talk to
there's
those.
Just so many of you. If I just spent my whole day talking to artists that walked in, I'd never get anything done. But I'm just saying that I don't mind talking to people that come in, but if I'm not too busy. And I think it's fun. Like, I think Ivan Karp, if you know his gallery, was a kind of a someone I admire and emulate, because he did four shows a month in this gigantic space, and people came in and bought from him. He probably sold more art than anybody else ever, and he discovered two movements. He discovered pop art and then photorealism. So he, you know, is a really important dealer. There should be like a statue of him
in
Soho.
Ivan Karp?
Ivan Karp, yes. You can read about him. There's a book called The Art Dealers. It's out of print, but you can still get it. It's by somebody, Jones is the guy's name, who wrote it. And he has, I think, the longest. They interview all these dealers, including like Mary Boone, and this was done in the 80s. And his, he's so articulate. He has such an incredible vocabulary, and I'm still in touch with his son, a great guy. But they closed the gallery about a year after he passed away. They just, you know, it's hard because you get galleries. Personality is so involved with the owner that it's hard to keep it going.
But I mean, I do feel like so I spent most of my life as an emerging artist. Like, I feel like, you know, like
you're still emerging.
No,
10 years
no,
later.
I think I'm no longer emerging.
You're the queen of Instagram, I think.
I'm like the long, like I'm the artist that has taken the longest to emerge. I think in like the history of the planet. I was like 35, still emerging. You know, 10 years
okay.
later. You know, but
how many artists actually emerge? So
I don't know what I've emerged into, but I refuse to go into another show.
Better than submerge.
Like, that's true. But here's the thing.
I think I'm a submerging artist.
So I feel like you're willing to deal with emerging artists, but you're not really an emerging artist. You like gallery. You're a mid, you know, like you're a mid career artist gallery.
Yes, we
who's
are.
Who's open minded enough to, you know, but to take people like me and my sister every once in a while. But I feel like I've spent most of my career actually dealing with like emerging artist galleries, willing to take a risk on someone, whatever, someone who didn't have much of a career, and I feel like things are hitting them, so, like whatever changes are taking place in the art world, like Pace is basically buying up blocks, and a lot of the places I used to deal with are just closing down one by one.
Yes, like I was sad to see the Lodge Gallery close, for example. They did some really cool shows, and I'm like, how do you guys do it? Where do you find all this cool art? You know, I just, maybe it was you.
It was me. But no, Jason, you guys interviewed Jason.
He was our
first
podcast guest, Jason.
Really?
Yeah.
He's a really cool guy.
He is really
amazing. Maybe I should hire him. What's he doing?
You should
check into it.
He is looking for like the next big project, I think. Or like the next thing.
He has his ear to the ground. He's like really like a passionate guy, sort of like you. Like, he loves art, and I think in some of these galleries that seems to be missing. It's just commerce.
I mean, and he's charming as fuck. I mean, like,
that's because the overhead is so high. It's hard to not be commerce oriented. I mean, you have to need product. You need something to sell, and you need a steady income. And if you don't have backers, artist who's like kind of breaks out and sells like crazy.
And I think Jason was in it for like the love of it, but he was also like, he's very personable. He could talk to anyone. Like he'd be a good person to work with.
Yeah,
I think he would.
He's also very practical. Like, he has his own business right now.
He's not living in the street.
You know, a bunch of collectors. So,
but speaking of that, something we were kind of talking about at the beginning is that sort of low middle class gallery eroding. You know, I think we talked a little bit about that off mic. Is it all the Paces and the Gagosians taking everything? Is that a
no,
problem?
No, there's just no room for, I would just say, bad shows. How about that?
Uh-huh.
There's no room for a bad show because no one come back to your gallery again.
Yeah.
So you really got to be on your game.
You got to really
make sure every hanging is superb and every artist is the best you can, possibly get. And, you know, I don't let the artists in the room when I'm hanging a show.
Mm-hmm.
Because I want it to look a certain way. And I'm trying to elevate figurative art or whatever you want to call it to the level of every other kind of art that's being shown. So that means expensive lighting and sparse hangings, and I think we're achieving that on some level, but it's difficult.
You put on beautiful shows.
Thank you.
Like everything I've ever seen at your gallery is just gorgeous.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Gorgeously hung and gorgeously lit.
It's an art form in of itself for sure. The ones Ton and I have hung are really hard. You get a bunch of work, you lay it out, and it's just like, how do we make this flow through? How does this work as its own art object?
Yeah. What I remember about working with Jason, I mean, there's several of us. I curated that show for him, and it was just, I mean, there's like some last minute scrambling, artists who didn't drop off until the day of the hanging, like mid afternoon. And yeah. I remember I walked in there at like some really like odd time of like, I mean, it was dark out, everything was closed. And Jason's in there, and he's coughing like he's got some sort of I think he had pneumonia. like he sounds horrible. He sounds like he's going to keel over and die. And he's just by himself in there making sure every single painting is, like, hung perfectly.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah. And
his concepts are great, too.
But anyway, the big galleries, you asked about them. They're going to do what they have to do to survive, you know? So
I heard this theory, this is interesting, kind of, you know, 10 years back on the internet, and they were saying where this is headed is, imagine your local CPA, you know, like your public accountant or whatever. That guy, that used to employ a bunch of people, right? There was one on everywhere. And now it's just TurboTax. One company took all those jobs and grabbed it. You know what I'm saying? And they were talking about how the internet will level and consolidate a lot of stuff into one entity that's a big channel, and a lot of the lower, you know, sort of the boots to the ground people.
Let me tell you one thing that's going on right now, right today. I don't know if you've seen this show with Rammel Z. Do you know who he is? He died. Rammel Z was a graffiti artist. And he had his own way of working. He used a lot of resin in his work and spray enamel, and he was quite a character. He was in a show of mine I did called Urban Abstraction, and it was essentially graffiti artists who worked, who were just making abstract art, no more sprayed letters or anything. Like Futura was in the show. Anyway, Rammel Z died, and his estate, I don't know who's in charge of it, but Sotheby's has taken it over. And they hired a well-known curator to organize the show, somebody that knew him. They're making a book. They they're positioning him as like the next Basquiat. Mm. And this cost many hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars, to turn this guy into a household name.
Uh-huh.
From the underground. Like, he was kind of an underground artist. And that's what the art world machine is doing. That's like what they're generating, new things to sell. It's like with Wesselman. Let's put this beautiful show together so we can have more million dollar paintings to sell.
So if I understand you correctly, they're finding a surplus cheap, glorifying it to a star status, and then selling it off. Similar to what you explained about Warhol.
Correct.
After, yeah.
Correct.
That's happening in a lot of different industries, the music industry,
but I feel like the art market is where it's totally deregulated. I have a theory that if the art market were held to, like, you know, the same standard as, like, finance, you know, just like hedge funds, there'd be so many people in prison right now. But like, you know, insider trading. I mean, because this is what insider trading is, right? Like, a bunch of people get together and decide to drive the value of something up, and, you know, by, like, investing money into it. And
well, the same guy, that Bacon painting that sold, he was selling it at auction and was a buyer tacked on again. You can't do that on Wall Street. Like, you can't. You know what I'm saying? It's totally deregulated. So basically, he was just looking to drive up prices, which happens all the time.
Yeah, it's legal to corner the market.
Uh-huh.
It's legal.
High tide raises all ships. If you got five Bacons, buy another one for twice as much, and they all go up, right?
Yes, that's correct.
So weird.
So you were talking, I guess when we were off air, you were talking a little bit how being an art dealer is a little bit of like, you see if I get understood you correctly, it's a little lonely because, like, artists do constantly have other artists to talk to, whereas, you know, like do you make like gallery director friends, or is that mostly rivals or people you vaguely look, you know, up the
Is there brunch for
well I like, think like you know we find each other, and we can talk on some level, but on the, as far as the day-to-day operations of the gallery, I think you're pretty much on your own. And I like to employ a lot of kids, I call them, because they know what's going on and they understand technology and they are open to new art, and they're just fun, and it creates a really good atmosphere. I also have some really experienced people. I have one woman who works with me, Laura. She's my art fair director, is her title, and she does all the applications. She writes up the submissions. She we work on what we're going to submit for this particular fair or that, and she, you know, she has, she worked for she worked for Sonnabend, if you remember that gallery. She worked for some other big galleries. So Sonnabend was the first dealer to represent Jeff Koons, for example.
Oh.
So it's good to have a balance of, I think, young people and experience to hopefully, look, it's a business. It's not your social life, but it is a very social business. So it's, but as far as like relating to other dealers, it's not easy.
Are there any you can call friends?
Yeah, absolutely.
Are there any names that you?
I'm not going to go there right now.
You don't have to name names.
I'm not going to go there.
I imagine your life has, like, in that way, the interactions you have with a lot of people at openings and stuff must be people kind of wanting something from you. Do you know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah,
you're
true.
Seeing a lot of people who want to get on your walls, and they're angling for that, right? And
yeah, that's true.
How does that affect you
affect
socially?
Your life?
Yeah, because I'd be like, fuck this. I'm not talking to you. Like, you know what I'm saying? It would be frustrating.
Frank actually does talk to people. Like,
yeah, I don't. I don't care what you want. That's my attitude. I'm sorry, but I just want, you know, to have a good time too. You know, and you know, the art business is kind of tricky. You can't go to school to really learn it. You kind of have to. There's something called, I guess, museum studies. Yeah. You can learn.
How many people that graduate with a degree with that actually run a gallery? And you know,
you know, I don't know. I'm not exactly sure if you.
Yeah, that sounded really condescending, Tom.
There was a beautiful show in. There was a beautiful show in Philadelphia about the guy. I'm not going to remember his name now, but one of the first modern dealers, who showed all the Impressionists, and people thought he was crazy, that this was horrible work, it was a fraud, and he kept a book, which is very much like the books they still use, where you open it up, because they had it in a case, and it would just say Monet, and then the name of the painting, and the date, and the dimensions, and the price, in French francs or something, and each one, it just went down, this book, and they had it open to the page, and it was all these famous
classic
Impressionist
ledger.
Painters, and they still use that system.
Wow.
We still use it. It hasn't changed. And now it's on electronic or whatever, but it's still basically the same. So who invented this system? Somebody did. And it might have been him. Because the first art dealers, I think, were artists themselves. Like, I went to – did you ever go to Rembrandt Studio or anything like that?
Yeah.
It's
incredible. I used to live right near it.
Yeah. It's incredible. But he had to sell other artists' work to survive, if you could imagine.
Well, kind of like
it's
your
insane.
Dad in a way, right? Like
Yeah, exactly.
He started his gallery. Yeah.
So Frank, you actually—I mean—it also feels like you kind of both grew up and kind of started your business in kind of a crazy and fun time. So I feel like you have stories that I want to hear, and I don't even know the right I don't even know the right question to ask. But I feel like tell us the craziest thing that happened to you in your kind of.
Oh my God! Really?
Please.
This is the sun's going down. This is after dark, Art Grind.
Well, I'll just tell you that you know, my Warhol story. That was one thing, but toward the I was in this loft, And I had the gallery there for about 4 years, and things were kind of getting dour. Like, I wasn't really, like, the East Village scene or whatever that was, it was kind of on the outs, and I didn't know what to do next, and nothing was selling, and I was running out of money. And all of a sudden, someone introduced me to this artist, Steve Hanick. You know him?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And we did two shows, actually four shows together, but we did two shows in that loft space. And that was the first time I ever sold a painting for over $10,000. And that was like all the money in the world. Like, that kept me going for 6 months, that sale, I think. Wow. And then the landlord of my building wanted me out of there, gave me $20,000, which this was, I didn't even own that space. It was, I was renting it. Gave me $20,000, which was like more than all the money in the world. I'm like, I'll take it. And I took the sales from Hanick and the money from moving out of this loft, and I opened my gallery in Soho. And the first show that I had already been in contact with, I read this obscure item in a gossip column that the granddaughter of J. Paul Getty was a photographer, and she painted on photographs. So she was like, I did that photosynthesis show, so she fit right into that whole thing. And I thought, wow, she would be fun to exhibit. So I told her, I invited her to this crummy loft. She shows up in her limousine and her handler, and I'm like, listen, I'm opening this new space. It's not going to be here. We're going to do, you'll be have the first show and all this. And so we did it. And it turned out that she had like a manager. And sounds so crazy, but the manager also was involved with another project where they were promoting Pepsi-Cola. And they had all these celebrities lined up to promote Pepsi-Cola. And they were able to get them all to come to the opening. So we had, this was the grand opening in my new space in Soho on Prince and Broadway. And so we had Brooke Shields, and we had Michael J. Fox, and we had Bianca Jagger. All these people coming, Gordon Getty, came to the opening. And we were like in the newspapers, and I'm like, this is out of control. Like, I never, beyond my wildest dreams, you know. And the building wasn't even finished. We had to like put on the other side, when you came out of the elevator, there was no lights. So we had to set up some crates, and we draped black cloth over everything, and we lit candles so it looked kind of like a little bit spooky. And then when you came around the corner, it was like bright lights inside the gallery. And all these people showed up, and nobody cared. It was like, wow, cool. And the promo people didn't want Brooke standing next to Michael J. Fox because he's so short and she's so tall. So they made him stay in the back in my office. And all my new – that's where we kept all the beer. And he's, like, opening beer bottles on my brand new file cabinets. He's scratching the hell out of everything. And I'm thinking, well, if this is, like, the worst – and he's, like, signing autographs for me and my friends, and everyone is, like, wide-eyed. So that was my – probably one of the most fun times that I had, wow. I can think of.
That open was such a bang.
Yes.
Yeah. Like, how did you do – how did these people come? Did they – from Getty or
yeah,
what?
Yeah, yeah. It was all through the Pepsi-Cola promotion. Like, they like, went where the PR people told them to go. They showed up.
Oh, because Michael J. Fox was – linked with Pepsi at that time, right?
Yeah, that's right. They all were.
That's right. Okay, wow, that's amazing.
Yeah, it was a lucky break and really a lot of fun.
Wow.
So it also, I mean, like from the outside at least, it seems like you're reasonably fearless in your career. Like, you just kind of like, oh, I can make this work, you know?
I think that's
and
true.
And you just do. So that's, were there any moments when, like, you didn't feel that way? And are you comfortable sharing them?
Like, yeah, you know, sometimes
where you're just like, I'm totally fucked right now. How do I get out of this?
Yes, that has happened where you just either totally run out of cash or something happens where you're think, well, I might have to shut this thing down, you know. And I always manage to pull a rabbit out of a hat and, you know, keep the ball rolling. And it's not easy sometimes if you, you know, you just have to not let it stress you out or get to you. if nobody buys anything for like a week or two, it's not the end of the world. You just keep going and you just like cautious with your spending. And, you know, don't go to too many fancy dinners. Don't max out your credit cards. And then the next thing that happens is you make a big sale and you're good to go. So that's kind of how it is.
Do you like, does your personality like those waves? Do you like kind of the stressful times, the high times? Are you a thrill seeker?
I try to do, like, I work out with a trainer 3 times a week. I like to go hiking when I'm in the country. I like to spend as much time up there as I can. I have a country home. I have Mookie, my dog, who's not here tonight. I thought she would be.
I bought Mookie. I bought Milk Bones.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate that.
I was completely convinced that you would be willing to reveal your deep, dark secrets as long as your dog had, like, Milk Bones.
There's not really, you know, I'm pretty much an open book. Like, you could ask me anything, but there's not, you know... I don't mind. There's no, like, deep, dark secrets, unfortunately, I don't think. I mean, I'm sure there are, but...
I, you know, everyone has a few, but that might be for, like, you guys were planning to do an after-hours, you know, but like, yeah. Like, section of this... that might be for, like, Art Grinder Part 2. Mm-hmm. Yes. Know, like, people reveal, like, they reveal their deep, dark secrets.
So. Yes.
You know,
yes, we... everyone's going to be asking me, how is Art Grinder?
But it is a thrilling life in a way. I mean, for artists and art dealers, just that you're following just as much as an artist does, like that creative dream and impulses based on aesthetics and stuff. And then
that's right.
Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. And it's a hard life to pursue, right? Because you're sort of, you know, a little bit the whimsy of the public.
Like, it's much worse, actually. I feel like being an artist is difficult, but not nearly as difficult as running a gallery, which just seems impossible. Like, I don't know how anyone does it.
You don't have the responsibility of, you know, all of these artists that you try to support.
Do you feel responsibility for artists? Like, if a show doesn't go well, do you feel...
Yeah, I do. I do, you know, because I know how much time and effort they put into it. And if it's not doing well, that sucks for everybody.
Yeah,
not just them, me and them, but it just, you know, it happens. You can't control people's reaction to a show.
Right, right.
And I feel like you can never control what's set. Like, to me, it's still, I mean, I've been supporting myself by selling art for, I don't even know, like 15 years, something like that. It still feels like a miracle every time anything sells.
That's right. I never take a sale for granted either. It's just like, wow, this is great, you know?
Yeah. Like it feels like some like lucky fluke, and I never get used to the fact that like this is actually like, I mean, this has been happening for a while. Chances are it'll somewhat keep happening in the future.
It does all feel like it, but it does feel like it could disappear at any moment.
Yeah.
That's always at the forefront of my mind. Like, well, I got lucky there. You know, people like this
month.
Thing.
Yeah.
But
I mean, I'll just say in my case, for a lot of galleries, they survive with a handful of collectors. Just a handful that pay most of the bills. And then the random sales you get are is gravy. So if you lose one of those collectors, it's kind of a disaster. So you really have to make sure you're always looking for new people and new support. And how's he doing over there?
It's good.
Okay.
Mood lighting?
Yes, we've been sitting in the dark here, by the way, whoever's listening. I didn't think these people were paying their bill here. But it's not the case.
Brought you here to murder you. Let's go down.
No, this is like, you know, your first gallery, right?
Yes.
Without the candle.
It is. It kind of is. I did. I had those clamp-on lights in my first gallery. I did. I had those. That's funny.
So is there because I feel like a lot of people who listen to this probably are artists, much like a lot of the people come into your gallery. Is there like any advice that you have for, you know, like, you know, you're a man of wisdom. You're kind of, you know, you're controlling some amount of like power in their world. Is there like anything you could like tell people that?
I would just say that I would really question my motives as to why I am making art. For example, There's a story about Ivan Karp again when he discovered John Chamberlain, who, talk about having no money, he was squatting in a loft building that had no electricity, and he was making those sculptures there. And he had an appointment in the morning to see him, and Ivan comes and he's like looking around, John. And finally he sees this like blanket in the corner, and it's like stirring, and this like naked girl comes out of from under the blanket and kind of like runs into the bathroom, and there's John Chamberlain half asleep, absolutely no money, but he was true to his he just wanted to make art. Like, he didn't care about being famous or about it. That wasn't even a thing. Like, you know what I mean? Being a famous artist was...
I really hope that not...
Well, when I hear terms like my practice, or there's all these kind of art school terms that I think are kind of make me cringe. But I guess art school has its place. But for the kind of work that I show, I like the academies and the ateliers, I think, are probably more important. Where you can really learn some skills, but then you have to figure out what to do next. Like, you can't just paint a perfect egg. You need to figure out where to go from there.
Right.
It's hard to do. Mm. Because an egg has been painted for 500 years. So you got to figure out a new way to paint an egg.
Someone who can figure out how to paint it in a way that keeps you like intrigued and right. Makes you feel the magic of that specific egg.
That's right. That's the key right there. Like, if you look at that thing and go, wow, that's like the most gorgeous egg painting I ever saw, then you'll get a show in my gallery.
You do have a very specific taste, and you do I feel like you've also stuck to your, kind of stuck to your guns as far as you believe this is good, and you don't really listen to anyone else, and you just kind of proceed as your road is very much your road.
Yes, it is. I mean, I try to be aware of what's going on around me, though. I'm not an isolationist. I want to exist within the art world, but I also want to be autonomous, so that's a little tricky, but I'm not working with a few artists who I feel that we just don't see eye to eye. Like, they want to make a certain kind of work, and it's not what I want to show, and so we have to shake hands and part ways. That's depressing if you've been working with someone for 10 years or more, but I have a good group now, and they're really, I think, undervalued, I will tell you, and underrated. They're really great painters, so time will tell.
Yeah, you took on some new artists, including one of our past guests, Peter Drake, right?
That's right.
Yeah.
I can't believe Peter did not have a New York dealer until now. Like, he has an incredible painting in our current show. It's like, the show's called Objects of Desire, and Peter's painting, there are two people touching the side of their house.
Yeah. But we talked about that on the show.
But they're asbestos tiles. That's what's ironic. So his work is a little bit political, actually, even though it just looks like some weird 50s advertising illustration. He's a little subversive, which
For sure.
He's got such a specific aesthetic, and like the texture of his work is so gorgeous.
I agree.
Congratulations for
thank
you.
Getting a good
Peter.
Artist.
He is good.
A big fan of Peter. Like, everyone who's ever met him is a big fan of Peter.
He's really a wonderful guy.
Well, he's a nice marriage of what you were talking about, like technique and concept too. Like,
that's right.
He's a great example of that.
Yes.
Do you find that, I don't know, this might be self-aggrandizing, but you were talking a little bit about like doing art for the right reasons, you know what I'm saying? And do you find a lot of figurative painters, because of the marketplace in general, like, it's not that you're not going to break out as like Basquiat or whatever doing this type of work? Do you find that draws a certain type of people with a certain type of integrity to that sort of art?
Well, I'm not going to show an artist because he tells me X, Y, and Z famous collector bought one of his pieces or bought five of them. You know, if she thinks your work is so great, then she could show it.
Uh-huh.
Because, you know, it cost $100,000 to do a show of an artist in New York City, at least. Wow. If you add up the rent, the staff, the cards, the mailing, the insurance, the catalog, the trucking, whatever else, the maintaining your website, just it's very, very expensive.
Yeah.
So just because so-and-so bought one of your paintings and spent $5,000, I don't care. I have to love it and think that you're a real artist. Like, I'm not going to show someone because they think it's cool to be an artist. Mm-hmm. That's all.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah. I mean, I do feel like the as far as like contemporary realism goes, I mean, it attracts a lot of people like us who are kind of dorks and like how many people do you know in our world who are like, oh, I'm in it for the parties and to be famous?
Right. It's like, for
do we
no.
even have parties where we're not discussing Led White or something? like Led White versus Titanium is like not a good party.
But I think back to that point too. I think it does attract a certain type of person. I mean, again, self-aggrandizing, but for the right reasons, because it is not the path to mega success. And I think that kind of weeds out people seeking that. It's people loving to do a thing and oftentimes in isolation and no credit till sort of the day they
die.
They
as,
die.
As some of the artists.
For sure. You know, I mean, some of the best painters I've ever heard about, you find out they had no success in their lifetime, you know, and in our
yeah.
field, for sure.
That's right.
It's just like, what?
And really modest studios, you know. These are not
studios.
Architectural Digest studios where some of these painters live, particularly, you know, the abstract expressionists. They live like, not like bums, but kind of.
Yeah.
You know, half-baked kitchens, hot plates, whatever.
With lead white on the dishes.
Yeah. anyway.
Yeah.
I read an interview a little while ago with this artist with work. Do you know Lewis Chamberlain's work?
I've heard the name, but I don't know.
It was weird and bizarre and kind of a little Balthus-esque and a little like, I mean, it was like, I guess he would fit your kind of new precisionism. Mm-hmm. But I'm just reading an interview with him and the guy's like, well, I've been working in a movie theater for the last, forever. And then I work in this, like, I don't know, basement or this studio with no windows. So I just go from one place with no windows to like another place with no windows.
Like the modern Dave Bukowski.
I mean, he's so good. He was very humble. I don't think he's very, like, it seems like he's kind of scraping together some sort of living between the movie theater and the painting. That kind of work he does, like, you have to do it because you're, like, obsessed with this.
Uh-huh.
Like, there's no way he will ever become famous. Lewis Chamberlain, if you're listening to this, I hope you become famous. I really hope you do. But
if Dina loves your work, I'll take a look at it.
So, Frank, would you recommend any shows that you've seen recently that you think it's worth it, whether it be a museum or at the gallery?
Well, Frank's show, that was totally worth it.
I'm saying.
Yeah, I think to think all my shows are good. Just on my block, we have Chime and Reed, who I just found out is closing their gallery at the end of the year. That's very depressing.
Wow.
They have a beautiful show up right now. I would say, where else have I been? There's Marlborough Contemporary on our block, Pace. And I can't really recommend a show right now, I have to say. The David Wanarovich show is that, you know, if you like that, he was in my first show, my very first show. I think he's an important artist. He doesn't fit into what I'm doing, but he's an important artist. What else is going on out there? I'm going to see that sculpture show tomorrow at the Met Breuer.
Oh, yeah, that's supposed to be really good.
I think it's the last day of Saturday, I think, so I'm squeaking in at the last minute. That has John DeAndrea in it, who is someone whose work we used to show on 57th Street, so that'll be nice to see his work there. I like the show of the I thought it was funny. It was like fashion at the Met mixed in with medieval costumes and things.
Oh, yeah.
That was pretty wild.
I thought that was great.
That was really cool.
That was actually really beautiful.
And, yeah. But, and I think from what I heard from my I have an Italian student, and he was in Italy, and he said that the Catholic Church in Rome was really against that show. It was interesting.
I can't believe.
Yeah, because they saw the celebrities rocking the, you know, wings and all.
But I mean, I can't.
Well, just the whole.
Oh,
thing
that was
of
the
it.
Met Gala, though. This was just that show. With the
but it was all kind of tied in.
Like, I can't believe the Vatican or the Pope doesn't have something better to do than like, oh, you know, God, like the Met's Instagram.
Really. That's a way to get the news. Yeah. Who knows?
So there was some beautiful music playing during that show.
Yeah. I thought so too.
And we were all trying to Shazam the music, and no one could
figure it
out.
It
kept coming up like, "Sorry, no results." So it must have been some like what? Something somebody composed for the show, because it wasn't coming up on the radar.
Yeah.
So what type of music do you like to play at your gallery?
I like Miles Davis lately. I've been playing this album. It's from this French film called Elevator to the Gallows.
Okay.
And it's about a rich a woman married to a very rich guy, and she's having an affair, and they conspire to kill the husband.
Nice.
And anything that can go wrong goes wrong. And the film score,
that's what you're saying.
Miles is just that trumpet. It's haunting. So I listened to that, and then I have Pandora, so I have my A Girl from Ipanema station. I listen to that.
Nice.
I have what else do I like to listen to? I have my Sade station. Like, I don't want to listen to too much rock and roll. It just, you can't, it's hard to get any work done.
Yeah.
But I don't like elevator music either. So I try to find music that's really cool.
What do you have planned for the future? I mean, you just opened up this new gallery. I'm sure you have some really big.
We got a cool lineup for the fall.
Okay.
And we also we're going to be showing Nathan Walsh Cityscapes. They're very large scale.
Excellent.
He's British. We're going to show Stephen Salzman. Even though he's a precisionist, they're geometric abstractions, but he uses iridescent paint, so they're worth looking at. He's someone I've known also since the 80s. I showed him in my first gallery, and we're still friends. And then I'm showing John Bader, who is one of the original photorealists. He's 80 years old now, and he spent 30 years painting diners, photographing diners and food trucks across America, and painted. That's all he painted.
Wow.
And he's got a new book out with a lot of his paintings in it and his reference photos. And it's just gorgeous work. And this is the last remaining paintings. Almost everything has been sold in his lifetime. So there's about 16 paintings left, and we're going to be showing those.
That's amazing.
So I hope we can play some of those in museums that he's already collected by most of the major museums. So, and then, you know, we're going to do probably the Pulse Art Fair in December.
Okay.
Excellent.
Do you find a lot, do you participate in a lot of the fairs? What's your feeling on those?
I can personally take them or leave them, but I think it's good. It's a good way to advertise your gallery.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, who doesn't want to be in Miami in December anyway?
Right. Right.
Yeah.
It's just gotten overrun. So
I don't want to be in Miami in December a little bit, because the art fairs like seem completely unmanageable. Yeah.
Yes, it's unmanageable. But we just stay a week later, and it's when everybody leaves. It's nice. Nice again. You could go to
the beach.
You can go to the beach. You could get a reservation at any restaurant. So, and there's a lot of great restaurants in Miami. So it's worth it just for that. And then we're gonna do. we want to do a fair in China. I don't know which one it's going to be, but that is a place where I think it's important, particularly for a realist gallery, to locate. And but it's a little complicated with China because they're still buying brand names and they're not really interested in connoisseurship at this point. But I think the Chinese quote-unquote market is going to be huge. They're already kind of surpassing us as far as, like, their technology. I don't know if you guys heard of WeChat. Do you know what that is?
WeChat?
Yeah, I know what WeChat is.
It's what they all use over there. It's
like the Chinese WhatsApp.
It's more than WhatsApp. It's like Facebook, Instagram, WhatsApp, Skype.
All in one app.
Skype, yeah. And Apple Pay. Like, it's all there. Huh. And they're all on it. Like, 800 million Chinese are using it every day.
That's insane. It's like Hong Kong is supposed to have, like, the fastest internet speed in the world. And America is way down that line. And because of that, they're able to just, like, squish a whole bunch of different things in one app.
Yeah, their apps are great. Like, yeah, that's right. Yeah, we are lagging.
Absolutely. Are you doing in Hong Kong or in China?
In Hong Kong to start.
Nice.
You know, you should definitely talk to Jason, the guy that ran the lodge.
Yeah.
He knows more about Asian art than, like, I don't know, any... I mean, I can't remember. He was born in Asia. I think, right?
Yeah.
Or he grew up there. Like,
and
he
constantly goes back and forth from here and there. And I think...
Do you know where? Which city?
You guys did a 3-hour podcast. Yeah, sure. You better know where he's going.
That's a good question. We don't, though. Not right now.
We can give you his phone number.
Yeah. We can connect you guys.
So we've actually been talking about making the podcast shorter because we ramble on too much, but kind of I know we can keep talking off air, but as like a final question, unless you guys have a better one, like, what do you hope will happen to, like, you and the gallery in, like, let's say 10 years?
I would like to have at least one other location. I don't know where that would be. I used to think I would like a European location, but I'm not so sure that that's a good idea anymore. Time will tell. But that's my long-term goal, is to have a location somewhere else, at least one. And also to elevate, I think I said this before, but I want to elevate the type of figurative art that we're showing to be on a par with other kinds of contemporary art. And I don't just mean it has to cost the same, but it has to have respect.
Mm-hmm.
So
that's my goal. In that case, we're on the same side.
Yes, that's great.
I agree.
That's part of why we're doing this entire thing. Like the because
support the sort of art.
That seems
that's
to
great.
Be every facet of my life is trying to do that. Yeah. Well, thanks so much, Frank.
Thank you
for
so
coming
much.
Out
for coming
okay,
and
you're
being
welcome.
On. This is great.
Yeah.
My pleasure. It was fun.
But please take the dog treats back to Mookie.
Yes, please take them.
Thank you so much.
Or else Marshall will have to eat them.
Thanks for listening to Art Grind. You can find Frank at Art Dealer on Instagram and listener donations. Ton, we had some more donations come in.
Yes, we have. Shout out to Alexandra Vilichenko. I hope I'm not butchering her last name, but she's an amazing painter. You can find her on Instagram at Alexandra Vilichenko. That's AlexandraVilichenko.
Thank you so much, Alexandra. And we'll talk to you guys next time. Thanks for listening. Bye.
Stay on the grind while we feed your mind.
Yeah, bye. Peace.